As I started writing this volume, I came to recall what an old-fashioned Chinese man said about the white people. When asked if the white people were civilized, he made this categorical statement. "Civilized? Far from it. You can't civilize these foreign devils. They are beyond redemption. They live weeks and months without touching a mouthful of rice, but they eat the flesh of bullocks and sheep in enormous quantities. Nor do they eat meat cooked in small pieces. It is carried into the dining room in huge chunks, often half raw. They cut and slash and tear it apart, and they eat with knives and prongs. It makes a civilized being quite nervous. They even sit down with women around the table, and the women are served first, reversing the order of nature." I could have written about the American people in a similar vein in the first or second week after my arrival in America. But now I cannot write in such a superficial manner. Having spent a quarter of a century as a lecturer in various parts of the United States, I not only have observed, but have actually lived American life. At this critical hour in world history, when the earth is reverberating with all sorts of false propaganda against America, I felt it my duty, as well as my privilege, to write a new volume based on my more mature observation of American life and culture. Few Asiatic authors have written about America for their own people, who form nearly two-thirds of all human beings. Although I have not written this volume exclusively for them, I hope that it will be read by many of my fellow Asiatics, whose primary source of information about America is the hostile communist propaganda, but will also help my American friends to gain a better understanding of their own rich, enviable heritage. By and large, a typical American is a hard-working person with boundless enthusiasm for work. He rises early in the morning, often startled out of bed by an alarm clock. He rushes to shave and dress, but is often held up by the terrific task of mowing his barbed wire-like whiskers, of which he is altogether too much, for he is about the hairiest man on earth, coming closely behind the monkeys. He now grabs the shirt and swings it around him, and ties up his neck with a horrible rope called necktie, as if he is going to hang himself. He then jumps into his trousers and his shoes too, which are as large as fair-sized canoes, for he has unusually big feet. He now races into the dining room and gulps his breakfast, or often skips it and makes a beeline for the garage, bus, or train. He finally reaches his office just about half a second before the clock strikes.
"I think this application is filled out all right, Mr. Arnold."
"Thank you."
At once he starts his work and goes about it as if he is going to pass out at the end of the hour. But somehow he manages to survive through the morning. He rushes to the lunchroom like a hungry tiger. He grabs a sandwich and throws the whole business into his big mouth. He would have choked to death long ago but for coffee, which washes the sandwich down to his tummy. He then runs back to his office and works and works. To him, work is his religion, his recreation, and his life. You take work away from him, and you will kill him. He is born to work, he lives to work, and he dies for his work. He has no time to be graceful, polite, and stylish. He rushes all the way from the maternity ward to the graveyard, and at the graveyard, he gets his first real rest. In fact, even after their death, most Americans do not seem to get much rest, for some of them believe that heaven is not a place of leisure, but it is a sort of workshop, where the souls of the mortal beings play harps and sing and dance with the angels. The bad Americans, however, seem to get some rest after their death, for according to some Americans, hell is a place of rest, where there is nothing for a man to do. A typical American is a born optimist. He's not cast into gloom by thousands of failures, but he is always exhilarated by one success, or a remote possibility of success, which may never come. The very belief that a man can shape his own destiny was born of the American experiences in the new world of abundant opportunities. Had the opportunities for success been as scarce as in the old world, and had Americans suffered successive defeats without end, such as the people of the old world, they too would probably have believed that fate is what God or nature decrees. Unfortunately, these sacred American ideals have not always succeeded in penetrating the color line. For instance, even at this moment, when the American boys are dying for freedom in Korea, the Koreans, Japanese, Siamese, Indonesians, and Polynesians are still excluded from the citadel of American democracy. And those who are already in the United States are not allowed to enjoy the privilege of becoming American citizens. It is doubtful if America can gain the wholehearted support of the East for the cause of freedom without getting rid of this cancerous disease, race prejudice. Despite this, truly, not until I found a sanctuary in America did I have a taste of liberty. Having grown up under the shadows of the Japanese secret police and Manchurian bandits, I did not know what peace and freedom meant. I still remember how I felt when I had the first taste of freedom in the sweet land of liberty, out of the reach of Japanese secret police and Chinese bandits. I'm putting it mildly when I say that my first taste of freedom in America was as thrilling as the first kiss of a young lover. All the loose talk that there is no more freedom in America than in the totalitarian countries is outright communist propaganda, or the foolish utterances of the ignorant and irresponsible Americans who have enjoyed freedom and democracy for so long and so much in this blessed country that they have forgotten the meaning of tyranny and despotism. Even the rich and powerful are often sued, defeated, fined or jailed by the common man, who is supposed to be a helpless slave to his capitalist master. It is about the only great democratic country in the world where any man can criticize, attack, or condemn and denounce his government with no more compunction than he would feel in scolding his dog or in whipping his horse. It is about the only country under the sun where any man can even call the president of his country SOB, whatever that may mean, and can still retain his head and go about the country as free as a bird. I think this fact alone, to call the president whatever one wishes without fear, makes the United States the freest country in the world. Traveling up and down the country, I have attacked and denounced the American people and government for their indifference with the Pacific and Far Eastern affairs. Had I done this in a totalitarian state, I would have lost my head long ago. But no official or civilian has ever questioned my right to say what I said. The only thing which have deprived me of my freedom of speech and movement have been the blizzards and the labor strikes, which stop the buses, trains, or planes. The fine spirit of sportsmanship is beautifully expressed in almost every political election. The opposing candidates throw mud at each other's faces and call each other names in a way that no honorable man would dream of doing. They shout, yell, and swear in the strongest language as if they are going to kill each other off and get it over with in a hurry. Certainly few decent men on earth can think of admiring a people who lie and cheat as the American campaigners do. But the way they accept the result of the election arouses the highest respect of all men. In most countries, the loser continues the battle after the election. He accuses the winner of using dishonest methods in the election and refuses to accept the result of the election. I'm not going to give in. Let us fight it out. So the election by ballots ends in election by bullets. But it is not so with Americans. Both the winner and the loser accept the election result as final, although they know that the majority cannot be right always. Americans waste little time on history. They study history only to find the faults of their ancestors so that they may not repeat the same mistakes. This forward-looking frame of mind, as I see it, is one of the essential differences between the Occidental and the Oriental, particularly between the American and the old Chinese. The old-fashioned Chinese revered their ancestors so much as to worship them and feared to do anything which their ancestors did not do. On the other hand, Americans are never so conservative or so dogmatic as to scorn new ideas. Though it is a fact that many of these so-called new things are not really new. Their modern music, known as crooning, sounds little different from the noise made by a sick dog hit by a stone. Their so-called modern art is a crude and childish replica of the drawings of the cavemen, with one difference. The drawings of the cavemen were intelligible, whereas those of the American modernists are not. The American women have not introduced anything new when they wear trousers or long fingernails. The Chinese women wore trousers long before America was discovered. One of the funniest new styles I've seen in America was the so-called coolie coat, which at one time was worn by almost every housewife who could afford it. As I came to lecture at a fashionable woman's club, all the ladies came in colourful coolie coats, bearing strange Chinese characters on their backs. One of them read, "I am a fire extinguisher." Another said, "I am a water carrier." Still another read, "I'm a big, fat fool." Even the poor Americans, excepting some habitual drunkards or bums, can eat all the food which a man needs, and the rich men cannot possibly eat more than the poor. The wives of the rich men are not better fed than those of the poor men, for both classes of women just starve to death, not because they do not have enough to eat, but because they want to be fashionable. In fact, the only class of underfed, undernourished, and starving people I have seen in all my 25 years of travelling in America is the class of women, who voluntarily subject themselves to starvation for the sake of preserving slender figures. In old China, only the rich men and their wives and children had enough to eat and to grow corpulent. Corpulence therefore became a symbol of fortune, beauty, and charm. One of the commonest flatteries was to say to a person, "You look fatter than before." But here in America, everyone has more than enough to eat, and everyone can grow stout like the millionaires in China. So corpulence is no sign of beauty or honour. You call a lady a fat cow, oh boy, you are sure to get into trouble. Many American women grow so bony and skinny that I feel sorry for the men, for it must be hard for them, unless they be archaeologists, to grow romantic with a bag of bones. Of all the things that make Americans happy, and of all the things which make them work like slaves in building their civilization, the most important and the most powerful is the thing called love. It is no exaggeration to say that all their struggle for success, wealth, and honor has been motivated by love, which has been glorified in legend and fable, in drama, music, and literature. So, when I was a student, I fell for a beautiful, sweet, little American co-ed. I shall never forget how I felt. My eyes were fixed on the stars, my feet walked on the drifting clouds. My heart was filled with something which made me sigh often. My mind was blank and my head swam about in a dreamland. I couldn't eat or sleep. Subsequently, I grew dizzy, tired, and weak, and I felt as if I had caught a terrible flu. I did not know what it was at first. When I asked about it, my American friends told me that it was love. It was incredible, and I asked, "You mean to say this is the stuff which you fight and die over?" "Yep, that's it," said my friends. "Well," I said, "if that is true, I'm very sorry for you people who have nothing better to fight for. Personally, I would rather catch another flu." Modern Americans, born in a rich, prosperous country with silver spoons in their mouths, have never seen, felt, or understood the meaning of poverty and misery. Nor have they worked for or paid with their own sweat, blood, and tears for what they have. Naturally, they do not fully appreciate what they have and are not content with all the wealth and comfort found in America. Whether happy or not, Americans have built in their search for happiness the mightiest material civilization known in history. What they have built has served both as a target of attack and an object of worship. The critics of American civilization usually say, in substance, "You have developed science and inventions, but you have not improved your men and women. You have built great homes, churches, schools, factories, planes, and ships, but you have not developed your morals and manners. You have leveled the mountains, tamed the rivers, and transformed your deserts and wildernesses into farms, orchards, and parks. But you have not developed your cultural and spiritual qualities of life." But, in a way, it is fortunate for all democratic peoples that America has put a priority on developing her material power. Had she been too much occupied with producing her Beethovens, Miltons, and Shakespeares to give thought to creating Fords, Edisons, and Comptons, she might have gone down under the heels of Tojo or Stalin, regardless of her beautiful art, music, literature, philosophy, and religion, valuable though they are. Had she been ruthlessly crushed as other countries were, what nation would have served in her place as an arsenal of democracy and a reservoir of lifeblood for the teeming millions of the helpless and hopeless victims of war? Materialistic America, I take my hat off to thee. The melody